I have a confession to make. I published a book through a print-on-demand publisher.
Okay. What is your problem with that?
Well, my department did not want to pay for the two copies that I need to deposit with the New Zealand National Library as a fulfillment for the legal requirement of depositing.
Mm-hmm. Which you have to do with physical books, I understand. Are they the publisher?
Well, no, the National Library did give me the ISBN number mm-hmm. for the book, but they do not consider themselves to be the publisher.
And why didn't your department want to front up for this?
Well, they simply said that they've never done this before and that normally the publisher would take care of this and they just wouldn't pay for it.
So who is the publisher in this case?
Well, that is actually a very, very good question. And I don't really have a good answer for this. So in this episode of the Human Robot Interaction podcast, we'll try to find some of the answers for publishing books and journals. My today's guest is Anton Angelo. Welcome, Anton.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here, Christoph.
This is the Human Robot Interaction podcast. I am your host, Christoph Bartnack.
So what do you do here at the university?
I am a digital librarian. So I do a lot of stuff with copyright and I help people with publishing. And I also kind of run a little publishing exercise out of the library as well.
Wow, that's very impressive. So I guess to better understand publishing books and journals, we have to dig a little bit back into the history of academic publishing. And for my naive view, and I know that you probably have a much better view on it, it kind of divides itself up pre, post-internet, but you might disagree with that?
No, I totally agree. The academic publishing, scholarly publishing as we know it, started pretty much fully formed in the 1670s. The Royal Society published a journal. They like to think they're the first academic journal in the world, but we'll ignore that the French were probably a year ahead of them. Won't worry about that. They decided that they wanted to publish the proceedings of their scientific club. And the idea was you put in some money in a pot as a subscription and that paid for a book to get produced. And we've pretty much stuck with that model, that subscription model ever since, until, as you said, the internet came along and disintermediated everything.
But when we go back a little bit, so I guess the idea here is that you have scientists who want to disseminate their knowledge. Mm-hmm. They use a publisher to do this. And what then is the role of a library?
So the role of the library was very much, it was expensive for these subscriptions. So libraries would be the mainstay of all the subscription costs. So we would buy a copy of all the major magazines, all the major journals. And in the old days too, people would have personal ones. It wasn't uncommon to go into a departmental tea room and see journals lying in departmental subscriptions for those as well. We've got to a point though where they've become so expensive you don't see that anymore, and also they're so expensive that libraries can't afford to keep up with all of the journal subscriptions they'd like to.
So the problem, I guess, is when there are so many journals, how does a library ever decide which journal to subscribe to, which books to buy?
Sure. So we go through a very complicated process of talking to people like you. What journals do you need? Which journals are going to be required for you to do your work? So we go through large consultation exercises to do that. And that's part of it. There's also another trick. The journals decided that instead of selling us individual journals, a group of, in the, 70s, 80s, 90s, Rupert Murdoch decided to, Robert Maxwell, rather, decided to agglomerate all the journals. They started buying them up. We started buying them in packages. So now rather than buying a journal, we'll buy a package of X hundred journals as part of a big deal subscription. It seemed to make it a lot easier at the time, but it does mean that we're now paying for a lot of journals that our particular institution doesn't use. So that's been a bit of a bone of contention between us and the publishers at the moment.
But I suppose there were some other efforts to try to give libraries some advice on what journal to pick and which one not, which would be the Science Citation Index.
Absolutely. So Citation Index is one way of assessing a journal's quality, for example. So it's a rough index because if an article gets lots of citations, that means it's talked about. It doesn't necessarily mean it's good. We hope it's good. So that is certainly one way that we look at it. But what we'll find is that one journal with a high citation index will be bundled with a whole lot that may not be appropriate for our organization or may not have such high citation indexes. Also, that goes into the very complicated thing of what an article's impact is. And I think that's a whole nother podcast.
But when we go back, I mean, we have to, I guess, acknowledge that the Science Citation Index arrived way before the internet.
Oh, absolutely. And that was one way of assessing which particular journals were going to... It was a marketing venue for the journals to do that. It's a great game to play, getting citation indexes. You'll find that some journals will require that you cite papers in the same journal, same family of journals. Publishers like to pop their citation indexes up that way as well. And also families of journals tend to breed each other. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that will go on. My question for you, Christoph, though, is how many journals do you read from cover to cover?
None.
Exactly. So it's articles we're interested in, right? Not journals, is it?
That's correct.
Yeah.
I mean, when we go back to traditional publishing, in the olden days, I guess, they printed them in paper.
Mm.
And that means that there was pages mattered.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a longer article that requires more pages, that
Absolutely.
Might be more expensive.
Or a color diagram in it was going to cost you more. So this is where the nature of article processing charges came from. A longer article, or if you wanted a color photograph reproduced, or there would be a charge back to the author to cover costs that weren't covered in the normal subscription.
But I guess that has pretty much disappeared with the arrival of the internet, hasn't it?
One would think, but I think what we're dealing with is scholarly publishing hasn't actually taken advantage of the internet as you'd think about it, which seems, considering that the internet came from academia in the first place, it's quite surprising that it really hasn't taken advantage of all the elements of scale and disintermediation that the internet can actually provide. And that's happening now, I think.
I haven't been physically to a library to pick out a journal article in ages. So I get everything delivered to my computer through the internet, which I guess means there is some advantage of the internet. I mean, when you say it doesn't take advantage of it, what do you mean by that?
Sure. What I mean by that is the costs in terms, we haven't seen the costs reduce for articles, for journals. And one would think that the production costs would have lowered. If you're not actually printing the thing on paper, you'd think that the costs per issue, after the first volume is printed, you'd think that the costs would be much lower. But we're finding the costs aren't going down. And in fact, just got some wee figures here. In New Zealand, the top four publishers, universities in New Zealand paid $12 million in 2013. And then in 2016, that had gone up to $14 million. And that's just the top four publishers. So it's a vast amount of money that we're paying them. And it's rising much faster than the cost of inflation or materials.
But then the problem still is, if the prices are skyrocketing, in theory, if the market should be working, then the expensive journals would essentially, nobody would subscribe to it anymore, but that doesn't seem to work.
That's right. And even Harvard, back a few years ago, have said that they can't afford to have all the journals they want to have. So if someone like Harvard can't do it, then other universities in the world are really going to struggle. So what is the problem here? And I think librarians are probably the worst people at this. We haven't communicated very well with our clients, with you, the academics, the people who are reading this stuff. We haven't communicated very well with you the struggle that we're having with it. And we certainly don't communicate with you the price of managing it. So, I mean, if I asked you, do you know how much your institution pays for online access to journals for a year?
I have no idea.
Yeah. So we pay about $6.5 million a year. And that gets us not just the new articles, but access to old ones as well. So the instant we stop paying that, we don't have access to back catalogue things. So we're in a bit of a bind. When you get an article, it appears free. And this is known as a moral hazard, dealing with something that costs money without actually knowing what the cost of that is. As we move to a new business model, or as new business models start to exist, there's a lot of education that needs to happen about how this whole system works.
When I want to publish an article in, let's say, an open access journal, and I'll be expected to pay the fee for it, mm-hmm. which can range dramatically, my managers don't like that.
No, of course not. They haven't budgeted for it. And I completely understand that. At the moment, you're paying that $6.5 million through some university budget that, let's face it, who really follows the meetings for how that all works? And there are contributions that are made in particular ways, and it's all a bit arcane and part of the magic of the way university works. Anyway, thinking about open access charges, this is a really interesting change in paying. Instead of paying to read the article, what we're trying to think of is, well, who paid for it? And in the end, we all did. We all pay through our taxes to have you write the marvelous stuff that you do, to create podcasts like this, to all of this, so that your salaries and your wages are paid through the state. Wouldn't it be good if the people who paid for that had access to that information? And that may sound, in these neoliberal days, that almost sounds a bit radical and revolutionary, but it's not that unreasonable, I don't think. And especially as a librarian, we're odd bunch. We want everyone to have access to information that they need when they need it. So what we're doing is putting the cost on the publishing side. So as you have an article accepted, the publisher then charges someone. Now, that could be you. I also think that 80% of, a nice thing to remember, 80% of open access journals have no charge. No charge for reading and no charge for publishing. So when there is a charge for publishing, you've got to ask yourself a question about why that is and what it is that publisher is doing.
Is it actually fair that the taxpayers who pay for my salary to do research and then I publish it, and then the publisher itself earns millions of dollars and the general public, who already paid for my research, has to pay again for actually reading about it?
Well, you say millions. I'd like to put a B in there. So last year, Elsevier, who's the largest of the academic publishers and the most successful at this, and they are successful. This is a successful company. $4 billion US in profits on academic work on its own. Taylor & Francis, the next down, $2.3 billion US dollars last year in profits, not in operating costs. No, it's just straight profits they're making from something that was given to them essentially for free. So it's not, I don't have a problem with people making money out of this. There's a job to be done. There are jobs to be done in making sure that the quality of these things are good, in reviewing them, in doing all sorts of work and managing that process and making a living out of that. Who has an issue with that? It's not a problem. It's a super profit, though, and that, I think, is where I start to have an issue and where librarians are starting to, and also not just librarians, but the people funding the research, the research councils. In New Zealand, we have the Marsden Group who fund research. In Europe, there's the European Commission. And in the States, people like the National Science Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates, lots of money going to research. They're starting to demand that, well, they've already paid for it. Why shouldn't everyone have it for free?
That, I guess, is the question, where does the change come from? And the company that's making billions of profits, they will be quite pleased with the model as it is. Mm. So the question is, who's the agent of change? Is it the academics? Is it the librarians? Is it the general public who wants to have free access?
I think all of them. I think all of them have to work together. Librarians will always be slightly reactive, because we're always interested in making sure that the system works as well and as seamlessly as possible. However, we've got to a point where some people have actually just broken. The University of California Library System, for example, which is enormous and produces about 10% of the research in the world, have decided they're not paying their Elsevier subscription anymore until they can work out a fairer arrangement. It's not about not doing it. It's not about not working with these companies. It's about working out a fair way of managing it. We also have a combined European effort at the moment called Plan S. If we pay you for this research, we will also give you some money as part of your grant to help you pay open access if there's an open access charge as well.
That seems like a good step forward if you got a research grant and pays for it. In the example I mentioned earlier about my department or my college not wanting to pay some fees, that, I guess, reflects a little bit back on the internal problems that we have and how the finances run within a university. But coming back now to print on demand. So I published a book this way, and I thought it was a great experience and pretty useful. But these forms of publishing are, they are not quite as esteemed as going through the traditional way of doing it. So what's the deal with print on demand? What does it do and how does it work?
Sure. So it's a really interesting model. And once again, nothing's new. So Principia Mathematica, Newton's book, self-published. You could look at it. He did it the same way. He raised a subscription to pay for it and essentially published it himself. And as were books in general at that point. So what we're looking at isn't a necessarily a new concept, but one that we're leveraging again today. And an independent intellectual like yourself, a public intellectual, publishing a book yourself like this is a really good way of getting some long-form work out there. We're looking at a much messier landscape where we go from blog posts, scientific blog posts, which are describing science, right the way through to journal articles with more than 1,000 authors, because an idea, in, when you're dealing with high particle physics sometimes, an idea takes that many people to work on it, to bring it to fruition. So I don't like calling it self-published. I think of you as a publisher in your own right, taking it into your own hands. The old adage always used to be freedom of the press means owning one. And the internet, if you will like to think of it like that, the internet gives you a press to be able to do that. And when you say print on demand, we're not necessarily talking about a physical book either. We're just talking about getting that information out there. I'd recommend that people look at that as a way through this process, especially if they want to do something like write a textbook. This is something that is becoming more and more important. The price of textbooks is an interesting thing. It's been rising for a long time, and now we're getting to the point where textbooks aren't being sold, but being rented. And so you rent a textbook for a year. It costs you the same as a printed book, but you're not able to sell it at the end of your process, at the end of the year. And also it means they don't have to keep making new editions to sell new editions all the time because they've killed the second-hand market. So especially for things like that, where you're writing a book that you may be using very much within your own discipline, or other people may be using as a reading, as a text, no, I'm really in support of it.
I also recently published with some colleagues some textbooks, and we went through the traditional process of doing it. And what I learned from it, that it seems to me that the decision to publish a book or not is predominantly a financial decision by the publisher and not a peer-reviewed scientific evaluation. They do a bit of asking around to see whether other academics think it would be a book that they might consider for their own courses, maybe. But it's a financial decision. Print on demand takes away the necessity for a business model, because every book only ever gets printed when it's being ordered. So there's no initial investment into any kind of print one. So there's no financial risk of doing it. So in a way, it takes out the middleman. The publisher's gone. The books that you publish through print on demand directly go to Amazon, is available to everybody, and that's it.
I completely agree. There are some things I will defend publishers on here, though. You are using amazingly sophisticated publication tools, like things like LaTeX, which things like Overleaf are making it easier and easier to get to the point of being able to do text layout in such a professional way. But a lot of people don't have that straight to hand. Also, I will really defend the role of the editor. I think an editor is an extremely important part of the process, not just for typos and but in terms of the other intellectual work that an editor does. I know this may sound strange, but a hand-edited index, and this isn't just because I was married to an indexer for a little while, is a marvelous, marvelous thing, and especially for a reference book. So I will support some of the important things that a publisher can bring. However, I can imagine that getting the work that you've got into public view, using post-publishing review, which is, I think, a marvelous thing and something that preprints, we haven't talked much about preprints, but they provide an excellent way of being able to have, to discuss and to improve work within a communication and a conversation within your discipline. And then who knows what is going to happen to their work after that. And also because these things are magically electronic, so reviews, revisions, updates are much more achievable than they would have been with a print copy.
I also previously published something that can be better described as a novel, and I worked with an editor there, and she was indeed marvelous in giving me incredible good feedback on how to improve structure. Some things just didn't make sense in the book, and it's really great to work with a person like this. When we recently published a textbook for one of the most renowned publisher on the market, all of the editing was essentially outsourced to India, and the work was reduced to making sure the figures were correctly labeled, references were okay, all the technicalities, but almost nothing on the content basis.
True.
So while I still appreciate this kind of checking, I also see that, well, it's not as good as it could be.
Absolutely. And this has been proven, even that technicality stuff, some of the big publishers are letting through, and it's because they have a peer review process that works with your colleagues who are, of course, doing this for free for the citation indexes and various other indexes gets raised for. My concern is more about that they are not doing a particularly good job even in those technicalities. The example I've got, and I'm going to mention something that librarians don't like talking about, which is the Sci-Hub repository. Sci-Hub is a pirate repository of virtually every academic article ever written. It's quite astonishing and quite a mammoth effort. Of course, it breaks copyright laws, and for that, it's really problematic. But I think it's a symptom of a broken system rather than necessarily a way forward. I think that once we sort out the new business models, I think something like Sci-Hub will disappear. Much the way music piracy has evaporated to the most part. Sci-Hub, you can link to an article on Sci-Hub, and you can create a URL that links to an article on Sci-Hub. And it's been interesting how many articles in, say, Scopus, which is an Elsevier-owned product, how many articles, if you look through their reference lists, are links to articles in Sci-Hub, rather than to the proper version. So even that process, that editing process of going through the technicalities, is obviously failing at that point as well. So it makes me a little concerned about other quality issues as well.
But if I'm not mistaken, the University of Canterbury, and actually even you, also operate a repository at the university.
We do, and we're very careful to make sure that that is absolutely above board in terms of copyright and in terms of its legal issues. So how that works, if you publish in most journals these days, okay, let's take this back a second or two. This is, again, not a new idea. I remember in my undergraduate days stumbling down university hallways and people would have folders on the backs of their doors with their articles in them, tumbling out. There were often stacks of them on tea tables and things. Publishers would give you a number of what they called postprints or preprints, essentially copies of your article for free to give away, which was very nice of them. And that means you could just pop them in an envelope and send them to your mates. That was free advertising for their journal. They quite enjoyed that. So this is not a new idea that you are able to distribute your work, even though you've given the copyright of it to a publisher, you're able to distribute your work. So when it came to people having personal web pages, the first people to have them were academics. What were they going to put on them? Their articles. Makes perfect sense. Institutional repositories are using the same techniques to hold your articles, but in a sustainable and a findable way. So that what we do is we, for articles that are either open access or initially, or are published in subscription journals, but those subscription journals let us have, say, a manuscript copy of that article. It's not uncommon when I was studying to, this is before I became a librarian, when I was studying to find, you do a Google Scholar search, and you'd find PDF available at the University of Texas or something like that. And you'd click on it and you'd get a manuscript copy of the article, and you'd find that your institution couldn't afford to subscribe to that particular journal. So you read the manuscript version, you cite the published version, you may not have even seen it. If you do really like it, you can of course get it for free through Interloan, and we'll get it within a day or so from another university that has a subscription, because we share like that and we're allowed to. But you'll find that when you asked for an article through the institutional repository, the reason we're doing that is we find that once it's in there, articles at Canterbury that have a version in the UC repository have about 120% higher citation rate than articles that don't. So we're doing this for a selfish reason. We're doing this both for the greater good, because you know, we're librarians, we like that kind of stuff. We're also doing it because we find that it improves our rankings. And that's the bottom line. We get our citation rates up.
So what are your thoughts then on something like ArcX?
Oh, Archive. Yeah. Love it. Absolutely. I don't care which repository it is, as long as it's a repository. My thoughts about Archive are that's particle physicists doing what they do best, which is just being sensible. And they set that up in the 80s, late 80s. They were very early adopters of putting out preprints, of doing open public peer review, of doing all those things that we've talked about. They really had it sussed early on. Interestingly, the most recent one, BioArchive, which is essentially the same thing but in biology, has increased in size by about, I think, 1,000% in the last couple of years. It's huge, and it's got to the point now where I talk to biologists who say, well, I only publish, I only go through the formal publishing system for maybe a quarter of my articles. The rest of them I just put up on BioArchive. I get responses from my peers. That's what I'm looking for. I'm doing the science, and I only go through the, and let's face it, publishing is a pain in the bum, right? It's a difficult process and a frustrating one to boot. So only for the ones that are going to be really important, or as a result of the ones that I've already opened up for peer review. So there was a mid-career, high profile, but mid-career researcher telling me that, yeah, he's using these archive-like repositories. So we've got institutional repositories, and also, most universities will have one, and also subject repositories, and both are great.
But then we also have things like ResearchGate.
Ah, ResearchGate. Well, ResearchGate is an interesting exercise in trying to leverage the information about you using your social networks. It's more like Facebook, and I don't have a problem with social networks, especially if it's providing you value. And if you find the community you've got in something like academia.edu or ResearchGate is working for you, that's fantastic. But what they're doing is they're using your material for another purpose, which is looking at your network and your social graph. Is that a reasonable thing to do? Again, you have to make the decision whether it is or not. I tend to think that their business model isn't sustainable. So when people ask me if they haven't already invested a lot of time and energy in it, I would suggest that they look better at other forms of social networking. But, you know, if that's the hole that you've gone down and it works, again, different disciplines. There must be some disciplines for which this is their place to share. However, again, I don't like their business model in terms of being long-term. And I also have concerns. Are they going to preserve the material that they've got in them forever? I've made a commitment that when the University of Canterbury goes away, we have a plan for what happens with the university repository. It is being harvested by our National Library, for example, and that's just into a dark archive as an important New Zealand resource. But also, we're getting to the point now where, And this comes neatly back to the beginning of the conversation, legal deposit, where we're talking about potentially having things that arrive in the institutional repository is actually meeting legal deposit.
You mentioned the University of Canterbury going away, which of course is a dark future that I hope is not going to happen. But what happens if a commercial publisher goes away? What if Springer or Elsevier closes its doors? Since you don't actually receive paper copies anymore, you only, as you said, buy subscriptions, time-based even, what happens if Springer goes down?
That's a really good question. The Library of Alexandria problem. Yeah. And the Library of Alexandria is actually, again, nothing's new. That's a really good example because it disappeared over quite some time. It took decades, if not centuries, for the Library of Alexandria to be wrapped up and be destroyed eventually. And the same with this. What will happen is, as business models change, what happens if a big publisher goes out of business? I'm hoping that big publishers are like ships. They take a long time to turn around. And as that process happens, people will get interested in what we do with archiving. Now, I'm hoping that people like archive.org and will have the facilities to be able to manage that. But again, I don't know what their full preservation plans are. And this may sound, a bit of apocalyptic thinking, but we have to, these are things that have happened in the past. Archivists are ready for these things to happen in the future. So, if anyone from those big companies is interested in telling me what their preservation plans are, I'd love to hear them.
But this points out the difference in the library between the purpose of archiving and the purpose of giving access. And my naive view was, to some degree, that archiving is an important part of the library. And the New Zealand National Library, of course, predominantly, and every country will have their own national library, will be probably more on the archiving side of things. Whereas here at the University of Canterbury, that might not be so strong, the purpose?
That's right. So we're libraries are very much interested in providing access. That's our first and foremost goal, is to make sure that information is available appropriately and to the people who need it when they need it. And you're quite right. Archiving is a different, slightly different thing, which is, if I may just go on a little soapbox for 10 seconds, a little frustration when the Department of Internal Affairs merged the National Archives and the National Library, not realizing that were different things for different purposes. Archives are about storing and preserving material and giving access as appropriate. They have a little bit of a gatekeeping role as well, especially for things that are delicate or sensitive. A good example might be a library will take a book, that's fine, it's meant to be published, and will give us access to everyone, where a National Archive might take your papers, for example, when you retire, and store them, both digital and physical, but there might be personal papers in there, and we would only give access to those as appropriate. So you can see that there are very careful decisions to be made.
But of course, there are some other challenges that we're facing. And one of them is that, as good as open access might be, the idea of open access has also been abused.
Yes. Yes. Like any good business model, it can be used for good or evil. Let's start a business. Let's pop up a website and let's say we'll have a very fast turnaround on articles. How long does it normally take an article to turn around when you're getting published from first submission to actually arriving in there?
It depends a little bit. I just got a paper rejected within 3 days, so that was
nice.
That was pretty fast.
Well, at least you can put it somewhere else. That's the thing.
But otherwise, if it's with a journal, between initial submission to final appearing, roughly, if it's running well, a year. If it's running bad, 3 to 5 years?
Sure. So I edit a journal, and I've got an article that has taken a year through the process that I'm managing, and my author is getting really titchy, and I don't blame him. It's a pain. I get it. But let's create a fictional journal, and let's say we'll have a turnaround of 2 weeks. 2 weeks, start to finish. And you know, the reason we can do that is we're not going to review it. What we're going to do is we're going to put a few photographs of some famous people in the field up and say that they're our reviewers and editors, and hopefully that they'll never notice that we pop them in there, and we'll just take them down if they do. And we'll charge you, I mean, normal. Now, what are you paying for article processing charges? I think PLOS is $2,500.
PLOS One is currently $1,500 US. Springer around settles for around $3,000.
Yeah.
And it can go up to Science $4,500.
Right. So we'll charge $100 American. Okay. Quick and easy. Get your article in. Gets published on what looks like a journal. Now, that to me sounds like a good deal. So if we do that and get a lot of articles through, we can make a lot of money for very little work. These journals are providing very, very low value for what you're paying them. Even though you're paying very little, even though they're arriving into the scholarly publication system, they're not providing the authors with what they need. And that comes back to that editorial process that I was talking about before, that all of that important work, the reason why it takes that long to sometimes turn things around. I mean, I must admit I've taken it on myself that whenever I review, I do it very, very quickly because I understand that's not necessarily the process. So in the end, what we can do is create these journals that provide very low value. Now, my question is, there's a word predatory. We call these predatory journals. My concern is not that they're predatory, because that means that a whole lot of people are being victims and prey here. And those people are very smart because they're developing these articles in the first place. My question is, I like to call them questionable. So then if you provide that series of critical thinking about what it is, where do you want to publish and why, if you want to get something out really quickly, I'd suggest a preprint server. I think that's it's free in most cases. You'll get it out there and you've saved yourself $100 from going into one of these fast journals. However, you can also apply that critical thinking and thinking about something that is charging an enormous amount of money. For what exactly? So what are we paying that $3,000 for a high-end journal for? So if we start applying the same thinking across the breadth of it, yeah, sure, these printed journals are sexy. It's a lovely thing to talk about. I like to talk students through the pros and cons and providing them with alternatives. And a librarian will always do that for you. We'll make sure that a journal's an appropriate one to be in. But I don't like the idea of blacklisting. I don't like the idea of particular journals. I don't like the idea of thinking that it's a low-cost problem, because I think it also, if you use the same critical ideas, can apply to ones that cost a lot more too.
So I guess I have to make another confession, and that is I actually wrote a paper on nuclear physics.
Cool. Well done.
And you might wonder how I have achieved that. And I can tell you quite quickly, I used my phone and I typed in the word nuclear physics, and then I just used the autocomplete. And I just had my iPhone write an article for me.
Yeah.
I then submitted that to a conference for which I had received an invitation to submit a nuclear physics conference. And I thought, like, well, I'm a nuclear physicist, right? I can do that. I created this paper, you know, put some Wikipedia graphs on there, some fake references, make up a personality, send it off. 3 hours later, I got the acceptance letter back. And of course, then I kind of like broke the news and say, look, this is silly. You clearly didn't do any peer review. And the culprit in this case was the infamous Omnis group.
Yes. Yes. So Omni, it's really interesting. I've been reading an article about Omni and their court case. So Omni are a group of low-value journals that have been taken to court by the
FDA
to basically saying they're not providing the services that they say they're providing. And they were convicted of that. And this article was going through a number of interesting cases, one against Sci-Hub, one against Omni Group, and some other things as well. I'll send you the link so you can put it in the show notes. None of the money is being paid from any of these things. None of these court cases have had any detrimental effect on these publishers. This is something we need to do in a social way. This is a social engineering problem, not a legal one per se. So, and again, this I think just shows you the importance of yes, the internet and reducing costs in terms of distribution by using mechanization and automation is good, but that people editing brain power part of this is still very, very important.
But if we think about the business model, really, if we, the academics, they write the papers, they do the peer review, they have editors who guide us through the process. So all the hard labor work is done by the academics for free. Afterwards, the publishers charge all the libraries and so forth through tremendous subscription fees, an enormous amount of money, or if you choose for like an open access version, $3,000 cash on the table. Other than providing a technological platform upon which this peer review can happen, do they actually provide? And with the open journal system, three alternatives are available. So any academic can set up with small amount of effort a journal by themselves, and no subscription fees would be necessary because the technology of distribution and duplication is trivial these days.
Yep. And there are companies, and I'm thinking about people like Ubiquity, I'm thinking about people like Scholastica, who will run those platforms for you if you don't want to and provide you levels of service at orders of magnitude less than the big publishers will do. So that making a business of taking the hard work out of that for you if you want to. So for example, we could quite easily run something like that at Canterbury, and we're talking about that at the moment. In fact, we run 7 journals out of the library at Canterbury that go from a very high-ranking continental philosophy journal right through to student work as well, which is marvellous. The issue with that is it's always going to be local. It's always going to be us. So how do we scale that into an international and deal with that? I still don't want to minimize the idea of organizing academics can be a pain in the bum. And you've got it. It's okay to pay someone to do that. Yeah. I still don't want to think that there is no cost involved here. That would be remiss of me. But the model that I would very much like people to start thinking about is one of patronage. So this is where, and we do this already in terms of funders. So the Bill and Melinda Gates patronize people to write articles and pay for that. They run their own journals. It's an entirely closed system where the money they pay for is available to everybody immediately. I think of states, I think of philanthropic organizations, I think of state institutions like, I don't know, New Zealand government or even parts of the New Zealand government, patronizing the publishing process and platforms so that you don't have to worry about the money, the readers don't have to worry about the money, libraries can help the money flow because that's what we already do. We already deal with millions and millions of dollars with this already. We're set up to manage it and we can work out the messiness of it. And that also we start thinking about the actual outputs themselves as being the important thing rather than the number of them or the way that you've salami sliced it to get as many out as possible or all the game playing. Let's just do good research and get it out there and let us support you in doing that and take away the overhead of having to look after servers. That's where I'd like to be.
That sounds like a very, very positive and good vision of the future. But when it comes back to day-to-day business, what should I do with my department and my college not wanting to pay the few dollars it takes to buy a couple of copies to require legal deposit?
And so I've chatted to my boss and we're very happy to front for that. In fact, the cost of we would be buying this book anyway because it's one of our colleagues, a little bit extra to get a paper copy of it. In terms of those other costs, isn't an issue at all. And I must admit, you chose a very low-cost provider as well, so that was really appreciated, because I suspect that wouldn't necessarily be the case. Because I know with vanity publishing, and I don't like to call this vanity publishing, because there's an inference about quality that I don't think stands up here. Well, I hope it doesn't. I'll read it. I'll tell you afterwards. Maybe I won't.
Right, so it comes down to the question about who is the agent of change. Things obviously need to improve. There are better ways of doing it. Some of the problems we have are housemate. And as you mentioned at the very beginning, partly it's a form of educating people about alternatives, about how things work. And I hope this podcast does do a little bit help educating people in this direction. So, Anton, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Christoph. I really, you got me on my specialist subject. I love it.
Well, this is a podcast from specialists for specialists, so you'll fit right in there. Thank you so much, Anton.